A search for clues and clarity in Metro Atlanta.
A crime against any community is a crime against us all.
Following shootings at three different massage parlors on Tuesday that left eight people dead.
We just heard numerous gunshots coming from across the street.
The first in Cherokee County around 5 p.m. northwest of the city.
Our deputies responded and found multiple gunshot victims.
Then about an hour later, authorities 30 miles away in northeast Atlanta responded to a call of a possible robbery.
At 5:47, our units responded to 1916 Piedmont Road on a robbery call. Upon arrival, they discovered three females shot inside this location.
One suspect, 21-year-old was taken into custody in connection with the shootings.
The suspect was on his way to Florida, I believe, and perhaps to carry out additional shootings.
Investigators say they will continue to piece together exactly what happened and why.
He apparently has an issue, what he considers a sex conviction, and sees these locations as something that allows him to go to these places, and it's a temptation for him that he wanted to eliminate.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, writer, producer of CBS's Criminal Minds, and executive producer of America's Most Wanted. And with me today is...
I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And Jim, congratulations on America's Most Wanted.
Thanks.
It's going. You've already caught some of Most Wanted.
We caught the first fugitive 3 days after we aired the pilot. It's really amazing.
Holy shit.
So we'll be featuring that on this week's episode. So hopefully you guys can all hear about it. But we also have a very special guest today.
Hi, guys. I'm Breanne Davis. How are you? I am an actress for 20 years. I also just wrote a novel called Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict, coming out as a sex and love addict for 11 years of recovery, and have a podcast called Secret Life.
Wow. Yeah, it's so great. Thank you so much
for
joining us, Breanne.
Welcome.
We've been friends for quite a while, and it's so great that we've been able to work together too a little bit, because I've been on that podcast, as I recall.
Yes, you have.
Yeah.
We were wishing that Laura could be here with us because she has a lot to contribute to this discussion. But unfortunately, she had an emergency and she couldn't make it, but we wish she could be here.
Yeah, and maybe we'll do a follow-up. We were actually on Real Crime Profile covering a case, a recent, very horrible case in which so many people were killed. Eight people were killed in Atlanta. And we were discussing that and the fact that during the course of the news coverage immediately after, police officer decided to basically give the shooter's excuse. We never name the names of people who do those kinds of things, but basically proffered what sounded like an excuse, because he said that he was a sex addict and that drove him to commit this heinous series of crimes. And literally while we were in the middle of covering that, I got a text, and basically Mark, your husband, was asking me if we wanted to have you come on to talk about that, to enlighten our listeners about sex addiction and love addiction, what it is and what it isn't. So we're really happy to have you here.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm so glad to be here, because it angered me so much. I was like boiling when that came out, and my community was boiling. Sex addiction and sex and love addiction is a huge community, especially in Los Angeles, New York, London, and we all band together. And we're trying to get the message out there that it's a real disease. Real people die from it. We're not a bunch of violent people like going crazy with our sex addiction and killing people. And it just really bothered me that this gentleman or man or
this offender,
that he came out and used that as an excuse. And saying he wanted to get rid of the locations that were tempting him. It just,
That's ridiculous.
So why don't we just back up and start? Why don't you give our listeners a little background about you and what you want to share with us about how you have come to write a book about this and a podcast about it and other things.
Yeah, my recovery has been 11 years. I've been in the program almost going on 12 years, and it is a very scary disease. It's a progressive disease, so it gets worse and worse over time. And how I like to explain it very simply is sex addiction. Let's look at that. That's addicted to a sexual act with a person. So we're talking about porn, masturbation, going to massage parlors, you know, having multiple partners, one night stands, all those things. And then love addiction side is you're addicted to one specific person, or you move from person to person. So it's going after unavailable people. It's going after, you know, the idea of falling in love. You're in love with falling in love and all that entails. And for me, it was, you know, cheating and having multiple partners back to back to back, like overlapping. So it's really, people are a combination of both. And for me, my recovery was so hard. A part of me had to die and let go of my old patterns, because what happened is I did not grow up showing what a healthy relationship looks like. I didn't have the tools. I came from a broken home. I came from where I didn't want to get married. I didn't know how to commit. I fell in love with the idea of falling in love, and being an actor did not help that. It amplified, you know, fantasy, make-believe. And so I spent the last 11 years really, you know, getting to know myself, letting go of the things that I did, stop hurting people, seeing where my character defects are, making amends for all the things I've done wrong. And now I'm in the stage of my life where I'm of service. Mm-hmm. And what happened, you know, I came out with an article last year in HuffPost coming out as a sex and love addict, because I was tired of just seeing men get caught and saying they're a sex addict. And people were saying it's a male disease. And I was like, no, it's not. 50% of the members are women. And it's a disease for every type of life, like every walk of life, ethnicity, religion, everything. And I just wanted to give a face where it wasn't somebody that got caught. It wasn't just a male. And I wrote this article and it got 2 million hits the first month. And it just propelled me. Yeah. And I had all these people reach out for me all over the world saying how much it helped them. They understood their partner better. They understood what they were doing better. They saw that they kept going back to unavailable person, because underneath it all were a fear of abandonment, fear of loneliness, fear of being loved, worthlessness. We have this hole where we use people to fill us, just like an alcoholic would pick up a bottle to fill them, or a heroin addict would shoot heroin. And this moment happened in my recovery when a heroin addict walked in and he said, I can quit heroin, but I can't quit her. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I knew I had this for life. I knew that if I did not get to know myself and understand that a person cannot fill me, my husband cannot give me my worth, that I had to do it. It was an inside job. And that's really what the program is that we learn how to fill ourselves and stop using other people.
I think, Brianne, in terms of the case.
Yeah, it's a journey. It's a journey.
Brianne, I think in terms of the case that we're referring to, a lot of our listeners have commented on Facebook, and there's a lot of confusion on connecting sex addiction with sexual violence and violence. And it's kind of like you said about a drug, that at least from what I've read, and I've just been reading the Journal of Forensic Research, that, you know, while offenders of sexual violence and violence may be drug addicts, that doesn't mean the drugs caused them to offend. In the same way, mm-hmm. offenders of sexual violence and violence may be sex addicts, but that's not what's driving
them. No, not at all. And in fact, when drugs or alcohol or other substances are involved in offenses, what it typically does is it lowers the inhibitions of the offender. It doesn't create the drive to cause violence or cause harm to people. What it does is it lowers their inhibitions. Their internal police officer might not be as awake, and so they might do things that they wouldn't do if they weren't using, but these are things they intend to do. And they may be more extreme because their inhibitions are lowered. And I would imagine the same thing is the case. Being a sex addict may be something that they could use to rationalize, minimize, and project blame. And those are things that are very dangerous in the mind of an offender. So they try to, they rationalize. They say, the reason I'm doing it is because I'm a sex addict. I'm only doing something to get rid of the temptations out there. And the projecting of the blame on these poor innocent people who lost their lives, who were murdered, who just mercilessly gunned down, that helped him feel better about himself. It justified his actions in his own brain. And that is actually very rational behavior. In other words, it's thought out. It's something that he planned. And now they're showing that he sat outside for an hour in his car. And then it was another hour while he was inside before he started shooting. This thing, you know, he was probably building up his courage and looking for the right opportunity and making sure he wasn't going to get killed in the process. All those things probably were what kept him waiting. But the fact is that he went there with the intent to do it. He then drove across town to the next place and then walked to the next place. All those were intentional actions. And when he left there, he got in his car and apparently was driving to Florida to do the same thing all over again. And this is what we would definitely call a mass murder and a spree murder. And it's inexcusable. And we wanted to have somebody come on. And I'm so glad that, Brian, that you're willing to do this and to speak so openly about it, because it helps people. It helps people understand. It helps people who don't have that voice, who haven't found their footing yet, understand what's going on in their lives or in their partner's lives. And it also helps people understand that this is not in any way some kind of motivational factor to actually commit violent acts against other human beings.
No, and I just have to say, it's like you said, blaming the drugs on if a drug addict goes on a rampage. You can't blame the drugs. You can't blame an alcoholic that drinks and then goes and murders a bunch of people. There is no correlation to violence and sex addiction at all whatsoever. And they tried to do it in the past with, I think, Jeffrey Dahmer tried to say he was a sex addict. You know, Harvey Weinstein said he was a sex addict. And I don't know any sex addicts that have raped people and been violent towards people. And I know hundreds and hundreds of sex addicts. You know, this underlying aggression towards women or a race issue. And I'm so sick and tired of people using sex addiction when it's not the reason they're acting like that.
Well, let's talk about Harvey Weinstein. Yeah, he said he was a sex addict and that's what drove him to do this.
And Bill Cosby too. Yeah.
Yeah.
He sexually assaulted somebody. Sex addicts are not in our literature. It never says we sexually assault people. Yes. Do we take advantage of people? Yes. But sexual assault, rape, all those are not correlated with being a sex addict at all. It is nowhere in the literature.
No, they're correlated with being rapists. And
yes,
murder.
Exactly.
Right. And so I always say this, and if I'm repeating myself to you, then I'm sorry. But in order to get somebody who actually kills people and, you know, multiple people or in a series, you basically have a complicated mix of bio, psycho, and social. And the genetics loads the gun, the personality and psychology aim it, and the experiences pull the trigger. That means that all three of those things have to function together. You might have some kind of predisposition, but you also have your personality and psychology, which you help develop. All the many, many thousands of decisions you make in the privacy of your own brain help to shape your personality and psychology and push it in one direction or another. You can recognize things about yourself, like you said you have, and realize, I want to change those things. And you can push yourself away from acting out on those things. But the decision to do that is yours. It's also the decision of that offender to decide to act on it and not avoid it. And that is the difference between somebody who thinks about things, who's going through stuff, and somebody who actually hurts another human being. That is where the line is drawn. Once you do that, you give up all right to your freedom. You're taking somebody else's life or at least affecting it in some to some degree. And that is something you never have a right to do. So for somebody to then say, well, this is the reason why I did it, it's just a bunch of garbage.
Brianne, would you say that most sex, the typical sex addict, if there is one, is looking for a willing partner, not trying to exert control over an unwilling partner like you would if somebody were molesting someone else or
no, yeah, molesting, rape, sexual, there's a perversion there. And that's not attached to having a sex addiction. And yes, I've never forced anybody to get involved with me sexually because I did want power and control over them, but they were a willing partner. And when we speak in the program, we speak about dealing with consensual sex, but just it's an addiction. It gets us high. It's this feeling of being wanted and having that exchange of energy with someone else, but not really caring about them. Not in anybody's mind have they thought, I want this person. They do not want me. So I'm going to go murder them. That does not make a sex and love addict. And this guy saying that he wanted to get rid of the locations that made him act out, that's like an alcoholic going to a liquor store wanting to burn the liquor store down because it's too tempting for him.
And there's no evidence at all that any of those locations were actually sexual locations.
Yeah, exactly.
Which
not every
that.
Massage place is a sexual place.
And it's like, the other way. I think you should say most massage businesses are legitimate businesses.
Yes.
There may be some that take it to an extreme, but this guy just superimposed that on these people and then executed them.
Yeah, I have to just jump in here, Jim. I'm so sorry because we've had this discussion going on Facebook. I am a former licensed massage therapist. Anyone who assumes that Asian massage therapists are sex workers is racist. That is racist. Okay.
Yeah, to make any assumption about anybody based on their ethnicity, on their gender, on their race, on their profession is not legitimate.
And
you can't do it.
And assuming that women who are licensed massage therapists are sex workers is misogynistic. And I've worked in spas owned by, you know, Korean owners, Russian owners, Black-owned spas. I've worked for every kind of person. You know, you cannot make an assumption about these places. And please do not call them massage parlors. Mm-hmm. We do not walk around in feather boas and high heels and lingerie saying, come up and see me sometime. I mean, that is okay. I wear scrubs when I was a massage therapist. I trained with a cardiologist. Okay. We have clients, we're professionals, and it just hurt my soul to see that. And just please call them what they are. They're spas or their facilities. Sometimes they're medical facilities where massage therapy is practiced.
Right.
And I completely agree. But even if they were sex workers, you don't have a right to murder somebody because you're addicted to sex. That is not an excuse. You are a mass murderer. Let's just leave it at that. That's what's frustrating. There's nothing wrong being a sex worker if that's how you make your money and hopefully you're safe. I have no judgment on it. I know tons of sex workers and I love them just the same as a teacher or anybody else. But to go and assume and then kill a bunch of women because you don't control yourself is beyond frustrating for me that this conversation is even being had.
Well, and I hope, you know, I haven't seen the comments. I tend to stay away from comments, especially when it's about a case like this, because I know through my history of my work history, my professional history, that any kind of attention that you pay to these assholes who take advantage of other human beings is actually, you know, is eaten up by them. I mean, they love it. And
they love it, yeah.
And it's unfortunate that our media still has problems realizing that. And I think the fact that literally just days ago, another potential mass murderer was stopped, and it tells you that the coverage of the first one opens the door to the second one and the third and so on. And we need to shut it down. And what I do love about what's happened here and what happened in Colorado is that people are humanizing the victims. They're posting pictures of the victims and their families and their lives, something about them to make them real, not just a statistic. And it really kills me that people are still willing to point the finger of blame at victims who have absolutely nothing to do with the crime.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. And to take that opportunity to say something bad about a particular ethnicity or gender or race is literally disgusting. We are human beings. We have to stop putting people into little categories and saying, you're different. You're not the same as me. You're not equal to me. We just have to stop. I mean, you would think at a time when the entire human race is threatened by a pandemic that we would get over
together.
That bullshit.
Yeah.
Right.
So well said, Jim.
Let's start it right now. Let's do it today. Let's, from here forward, make every effort in the world to stop leaning into our biases, because every human being has biases, and you have to learn to not go with them.
Yeah.
You have to learn to diversify your experiences so that it normalizes the other people that you live with.
Yep.
That we're inhabiting this planet with.
Well, I think it's also focusing on empathy and compassion. For when you focus on that, having empathy and compassion for another person, it opens you up to understanding, like, we are all human beings and we all have a struggle and we all have stuff we are dealing with. We are actually all one underneath. It doesn't matter what the outside appearance is.
Right. And I think that there are a lot of people who are actually racist who, who see groups of people in certain ways, but they know an individual that they'll say, oh, you're not like that. But they don't realize that making any universal statement about any group of people, other than the statement that we're all humans, is inaccurate, because everybody is different. Everybody, every single person. But at the same time, we have commonalities.
Mm-hmm.
We're humans. And empathy is a huge, huge bridge between human beings, and we should build it every day. And one of the things, when I spoke at the YPO, the Young Presidents Organization conference in Vancouver, one of the things I said was, if you come into a situation where you're uncomfortable because people around you are very different from you, I could pretty much guarantee that the other people are feeling the same way. So take the first step. I used to say, reach out a hand, shake somebody's hand. Yeah. Don't do that now. Rub elbows, but that's it.
Don't do that now.
Right. But what I said was, what you should do is find something you share in common, whether you're riding an elevator together or on a bus together or are standing on a corner, on a street corner. Find something that you have in common. Share that. You know, speak about it. Break the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And you might find that this person is an amazing person that you actually have a lot in common with or can learn something from, and they might be able to learn something from you. The human experience, I thrive on that stuff. I love meeting new people and finding out new things. And to me, it's the most fascinating part of life. And I just wish that other people would get rid of their fears, because that fear and insecurity is the basis for most racist and misogynistic and hateful thoughts that come out of human beings. It's literally fear and insecurity.
Absolutely. I always say, Jim, we need to start with tacos, because almost everybody loves tacos, and you could sit down with almost anyone and eat a bunch of tacos and have a great time, no matter how different.
Especially if they're Koji tacos.
Yes.
Right? Oh my God. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Koji tacos are everywhere, but in LA,
they're delicious. Yes.
There's a truck that comes around and delivers Koji tacos. And they're spicy and flavorful and fresh. Oh, I didn't know tacos were like that. I thought all tacos were the hard corn shell, but it's not. But anyway, Breanne, we strayed across.
You guys went on. You guys are must be hungry. You're making me hungry right now.
I think you're right.
And I wanted to pivot to actually ask you something that about the symptoms about what is sex addiction and what isn't, because I know it through, you know, all humans through different parts of their lives have sexual appetites and that wane and wax. And you know, I have two teenage boys who are coming into their own with hormones. And then sometimes when women are pregnant, they might have a stronger sexual drive. And tell people what it is and what it isn't.
Well, here for myself, I can only speak for myself and my experience. Like for my sex addiction, I've never had a one night stand. It's not like I was out just having one night stands. It's such a gray disease. It's not like alcohol or drugs is black and white. You quit, you know, doing this. It's very complex. It's, you know, you could use your friends and use them and it not be sexual. We use, you know, our parents, anybody to give us the intention and love that we need. And on the sex addiction side, yes, you're run. Some people have more testosterone, are more sexually, you know, adventurous, but it really is about having power and control or having someone choose you and you be with them. And most of the time, even the sexual act isn't what's addicting. It's the cat and mouse game. It's getting someone to care about you when deep inside you don't care about yourself. And I think with young men, and I really wanted to speak about this and get you guys' thoughts, is young men these days, there's an epidemic right now. It's the porn. It's really, I see more and more younger people coming into the program that are struggling with intimacy and commitment. And they make sexuality an act instead of two people are joined together sharing this intimate moment. And with the porn industry, it's inflating people's detachment, their disconnection, you know, the swipe left, swipe right, always looking for better, something, you know, that will complete them. And right now they're saying with young gentlemen, it's an epidemic. And, you know, I have a young son that's 3 years old and they say young boys are watching porn as early as 6 years old. And that's
what?
It's changing the chemicals.
It's easy to accidentally, it's so
on
easy.
PlayStations, on game things, young kids are seeing porn way too young. And I think that's what happened to me. I saw a porn magazine way too young. I watched movies that were too advanced. The first movies I watched young was Romeo and Juliet. So I remember it was the 1976 movie. And I remember seeing Michael White's butt and being like, oh, that's a cute butt at 6 years old. And then I remember at the end that real love looked like this, that they only knew each other for 2 days and that one or two people had to die at the end, had to be willing to drink poison or stab themselves. And I connected that at such a young age that that is what real love and sex looks like. Wow. It's dramatic, it's passionate, and someone's got to be willing to die.
Well, I've always hated that fucking play. So anyway, but we're not saying that watch, you know, I am all for erotica. I'm a little uncomfortable saying that movies, that's not what you're saying, right?
Well,
that's not. I said at a young age.
Yeah,
I said
it's
at a
early sexualization. That's
yes,
the issue.
That's what I said.
When
I
your
saw
brain
you
is
young.
Not, yeah,
right.
When your brain is not yet
developed
enough
to
yes,
understand.
It can be, right.
Yeah, I wasn't saying don't watch movies. I love movies.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And I love it. And I love being in movies. But at a young age, kids should not be watching porn. You mm-hmm. should not be watching Romeo and Juliet at 6 years old. Like, that's not appropriate.
Right.
No. But I do get it with social media and people are, you know, every kid who has a phone can get access mm-hmm. to, you know, any number of different apps and different social networks and different websites. And that, unfortunately, leads them to sex a lot of times. Mm-hmm. The things that parents need to know and understand and get involved in is they need to talk to their kids about sex.
Oh, yeah.
From the time they are very young. Now,
yes.
It may not be appropriate for a six-year-old to be looking at pornography, but it is certainly appropriate for the parents of a six-year-old to be talking to that child about what sex is and what your private parts are. Mm-hmm. And actually, it should start much earlier, because children need to understand it, because if you give all these nonverbal signals that we don't talk about sex, you turn it off when it comes on the TV or the internet, and you change the radio station if they're talking about sexual words, kids get these indications that they are not supposed to talk about it, but it raises their curiosity. Mm-hmm. And so they'll find it somewhere. And there are plenty of offenders out there who want to teach your kids about sex. And the only way to arm them against that is to actually educate them in an age-appropriate and loving way, supportive way. And then kids will get a healthy idea of what their sexuality means and what sexuality means in general to other people, and also how people interact and how people shouldn't interact with them. And this way, they can actually help in protecting themselves. And if you don't make it a mystery, but you just make it a... this will be, I'll explain it to you now, but it will be something that will become more and more and more open to you as you get older, period.
An easy entree to that is through through animals, right? You know, dogs have puppies and kittens, and this is where they come from, and making it just, it's a natural part of life. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing secret about it. There's nothing dirty about it. But yeah, as you say, Jim, it has to be the appropriate conversation at the appropriate time.
Right.
And I don't know if I should, we may have to cut this, but you know, we've always talked to our boys about, you know, appropriately about sex, huh?
Yeah, and they might be embarrassed if you say this.
Well, we'll see. They don't listen to this. But you know, as they approached teenagehood, I was very prepared that their hormones would be racing. And, you know, we always let them know, you know, you're going to have urges and it's totally fine and you need private time and all this and that. And I accidentally walked in.
Hey, it's normal, but you're talking about it and it needs to be talked about it.
So I accidentally walked in I accidentally walked in on my son. He was having some private time, right? Mm-hmm. And he was looking at his computer, and we both were at first mortified, and then I was like, it's totally fine, honey. I would be shocked if you weren't doing this. It's completely fine. But I really want to look and see the image that you're looking at, because it was a picture of Princess Leia.
Okay.
And I thought, you know what? That's completely fine. I'm sure Princess Leia would love that she was that for you. And I thought
she inspired that.
Adorable. But you know, it's like, you cannot right. make it something to be ashamed of, but right. that it should be healthy.
The fact is that we in this country, unfortunately, have these puritanical roots that have created situations in which people just don't talk about sex or sexual violence. And it just gets thrust upon people in the course of their lives, and they're totally unprepared for it. And that's why we need to have parents who actually educate their children. The parents have to be educated first, and they have to make sure their understanding of what's taking place is good enough so that they can explain it to their children. So it's just something that I think we seriously lack in this country.
Yeah, and I think it's also discussing about porn and about the violence now shown in porn, and that's fantasy and that's not reality. And I think that's a huge issue, is that people are connecting violence against women with porn right now. And I think we actually need to look at that as a society and understand, like, this is not okay. And if that turns you on, that's fine, but that's fantasy. That's not reality.
Yeah. And it's actually not fine for that to turn you on when you're 13. It is not fine. It is that somebody should be fantasizing about. You should remove violence from sexual encounters. And if you're feeling like you're fantasizing about it, then that's something that you should work on avoiding, because fantasizing about it and masturbating and reinforcing that arousal pattern could actually lead to actions in that direction, and that would not be good.
Just so you know, I was talking about adults. I wasn't talking about a 13-year-old, but I'm glad you said that. But I was talking about consensual adults.
Right.
You know, in the BDSM world, like that is, they're allowed to do that.
Right. I know. And I just wanted to make sure of what we were talking about before.
Okay, good.
That we drew a line there. But it's something that everybody should be talking about. This is something that we shouldn't be hiding. We secretize sex and make it such an evil thing that it actually, I think, helps contribute to some people going over the edge because they feel like they're dirty because they have sexual thoughts and they then feel worse about themselves and they become self-destructive. And when you're self-destructive, you as a self are human. If you're willing to hurt yourself, you're much more likely to hurt another human being. There's a very thin line between homicidal ideation and self-harm.
And I actually believe you need to get rid of violence. My 3-year-old, he watched like a little bit of like a violent cartoon where there was just hitting and he wanted to hit. And I was like, no. Like you should not have violence in any.
I know. Why are cartoons like this? Why are fairy tales always violent and scary? Somebody should actually put Grimm on the, you know, on the cancel list. I mean, why do we have stories about witches trying to eat children and, you know, and foxes or wolves dressing up as grannies and trying to eat children? I mean, what the fuck? What is the purpose of that?
But it's even in like a movie called A Toy Story. That's a kid's movie. And then Buzz jumps on, you know, they start fighting and my son like got excited and started like punching. And I was like, no, like, you cannot watch that. Like, no.
I think we need
to talk to Disney.
Yeah.
All right, well,
where is the line where you really think that you should go see a doctor, see a professional, you know, when the compulsion, when it really becomes a compulsion and it interrupts with your daily life and it causes you stress and friction in your relationships? I mean, where is that line where you need to go seek treatment?
That is such a great question. I'm glad you asked that because 6% of the United States suffers with sex and love addiction and they don't talk about it. So when you have rules, say you say, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then you find yourself doing it. And that's what happened for me. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I had a traumatic experience. A mentor of mine died and I found myself 2 days later on location about to act out again. And I was like, wow, I cannot stop. Like something, it can't be everybody else isn't right for me or not giving me what I need. I can't stop. And I was having a moment in my hotel room, sitting in the dark going, oh my God, am I going to be doing this the rest of my life? And am I going to be reaching outside of myself for people to give me validation and worth? And that's when I called a therapist and I went and talked to her and she sent me to 40 questions. So if you're struggling out there, these 40 questions, self-diagnosed questions, you can go on now. It's type in 40 self-diagnosed SLAA, S-L-A-A, 40 questions, and you answer them. And they say if you get more than 5 yeses, you might have this problem. And I also say if you keep going back to bad relationships, if you keep going back to an unavailable person, if you find yourself flirting and intriguing when you don't want to behind your partner's back, if you find yourself on Instagram swiping left, swiping right, whatever, to get that hit of validation behind your partner's back, if you have to hide your phone, it's little things like that. It's those little things that all add up to being like, my life is out of control and I'm living a secret life. If you're living your life compartmentalizing and there's secrets that certain people know certain things about you, this might be something that you need to look into because you shouldn't have secrets. That is where our disease festers in our addiction is when we have secrets.
Well, that's really insightful. And we really appreciate you coming on and explaining all this to us and our listeners. And can you just give the site or whatever where people can go to find that?
Yeah. The 40 questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just slaw.org, and it, you'll see the little thing and it says 40 questions. You know, you can reach out to me at the Breanne Davis on Instagram. I can direct you there. I'm totally, I will answer all DMs when they come asking about sex and love addiction. I'm here to be of service. Or you can even get my book. I talk about it, Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict. And I'll take you through the program in a very relatable, not clinical way.
Well, the number for Sex Addicts Anonymous is 1-800-477-8191. And there is treatment available. There are support groups available. There is a lot of resources out there if you feel like what we're saying is pinging with you.
Well, Breanne, thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. We feel like you're performing a great public service, and we hope that people will get help if they need it, and it's just going to make their lives better. And that's what we're all about here. So we all also want to prevent any future victimization. So if you have a problem and you recognize it, get some help, please. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Yeah, Breanne, and Laura really sends her apologies. She really wanted to come and talk to you, but she'll probably talk to you offline, and or maybe we'll have you back again at another date if we can. All right?
Yes.
All right. Well, till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile, signing off.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800-2000-247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.